I'll be totally honest with you, I am very much surprised by the enthusiasm and interest this engine managed to generate, but it is undeniable that the interest and enthusiasm are there and they don't seem to be going away. So I have decided that it's about time that someone poured a big old bucket of depressing reality over all that wonderful youthful enthusiasm, and I decided that someone will be me. I'll say it right off the bat. This is obviously a very creative, interesting design, but there's many creative and interesting things out there, and being creative does not mean that something has the potential to penetrate the mass-produced vehicular market or change and revolutionize anything. The first patent related to this engine is from 1974, and its inventor, Eduardo Taurosi, has been working extensively on developing and promoting the engine in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But in all of this time, we have never seen this engine in a mass-produced vehicular application, not even in something with a very small, limited production run. 1974 was 50 years ago. That's half a century. If development started something like, I don't know, 10, maybe even as much as 20 years ago, then there would be some hope, because getting new engine designs on the market realistically takes a lot of time. You have to do the research, the development, the testing, you need to find the money, the investors, you have to prove the merit, because you're fighting more than 100 years of development of the conventional ICE. It's a lengthy, complicated, painful process. But half a century? No, that tells us that we are not seeing this engine in a mass-produced car or bike ever. But why? Why, D4A? Why? Can't you see that it has zero friction? Imagine how efficient it would be if it has zero friction. It doesn't even need oil, man. Imagine never having to change your oil. I want to see someone swap this in a Miata. I want to see a V8. No, it ain't gonna happen. And do you know why it ain't gonna happen? Because this engine solves two small problems, and in exchange, it creates three big problems. The problem that this engine solves is the friction of the piston skirt against the cylinder wall. It solves this problem by fixing the movement of the piston using a control arm or hinge, if you will. This hinge turns the motion of the piston from reciprocation into a pendulum motion, the kind of stuff you can see in a grandfather clock. And this means, this pendulum motion means that the piston is no longer free to do this. So the piston can no longer rock in the bore, and because it can no longer rock in the bore, we are eliminating the friction between the piston skirt and the cylinder wall. But what is important to understand is that the friction between the skirt and the cylinder wall is not a major source of friction within an engine. This engine, the Taurosi engine, still has piston rings. It needs piston rings, obviously, to contain the air-fuel mixture and the combustion within the combustion chamber. And the piston rings are a greater source of friction than the friction between the piston skirt and the cylinder bore. They are a greater source of friction because the piston skirt rides on a film of oil. A film of oil that is constantly splashed and or sprayed on the cylinder wall. And this film of oil reduces, obviously, friction. It's lubricating the skirt and the wall. And it prevents metal-to-metal contact between the skirt and the cylinder wall. That being said, a measurable source of friction still does exist between the piston skirt and the cylinder wall. And it occurs during the combustion stroke on the major thrust side of the piston, which is the side of the piston that is opposite the direction of rotation of the engine. This load occurs during the combustion stroke, and it occurs because the position of the piston and the rod and the crank and their relationship. When combustion occurs, it acts on the piston normally, so it's pushing the piston straight down the bore. However, during the greatest combustion pressure, during the greatest load on the piston and the rotating assembly, the rod is at an angle. The small end of the rod is at the wristband, it's connected to the wristband, and it's right at the center under the combustion hold. However, the big end of the rod and all of its associated mass is offset. It is outside the center of the load of the combustion, and so the combustion is essentially trying to do this. It's trying to flip the rod over. As the rod is trying to flip over, as it does this, it takes the piston and it pushes the major thrust side against the cylinder wall. It creates an increased load of this side of the piston against the cylinder. However, oil is very good at resisting loads, and if the engine is running properly, this increased load can never break apart the oil and metal-to-metal contact does not occur. However, this increased source of friction does cause the engine to wear in an oval, uneven, egg-shaped manner. But this wear occurs over the entire life of the engine, which is around 300,000 kilometers. In other words, uneven cylinder wear due to the friction between the skirt and the cylinder is a problem that has been solved long ago, and it does not shorten the life of the engine. Now, the Taurosi engine eliminates this load of the piston skirt, the major thrust side against the bore, because we now have a big hinge keeping the piston in place. We now have two rigid points of piston control instead of just one, as in a conventional engine. The rod can't do anything to the piston because the hinge makes sure that that doesn't happen. It keeps the piston completely unrockable in the bore, if you will. Now, in theory, this hinge should also help with piston ring friction, because in a conventional engine, what stabilizes the piston and the bore is essentially the oil, the film of oil, and the skirt riding on it, as well as the piston rings themselves. However, if we relieve the piston rings of that duty, it should help with friction, and it should result in a more consistent contact between the piston rings and the bore, which will now be undisturbed by the piston trying to rock in the bore. Unfortunately, I can't give you any numbers that would quantify how much we have reduced piston-related friction with a Taurosi engine, and I can't give you numbers because nothing has been published that is a result of a third-party scientific test that compares the Taurosi engine with an equivalent conventional engine, and that these tests have never been done. However, what we do have that gives us some sort of numbers are claims. And one of these claims comes from this video from a channel called Repairman22. This is one of those AI voice videos, and it talks about the engine. This was followed up by another video 3 months later, which is also an AI voice video, but with different animations and pretty much the same claims as the first video. And these claims seem to echo the claims of the inventor. But it is these two videos that have created all this newfound interest and enthusiasm in the Taurosi engine. It is not the inventor himself, because he stopped actively promoting the engine around 11 years ago. His website is also completely inactive. So it is these two videos that have brought up all this enthusiasm. Well, not for long. So let's address one of the most important claims from these videos, which is a 30% improvement in fuel economy, which apparently occurs because we have reduced or completely eliminated piston-related friction with the Taurosi design.
Although the most important thing is that friction is reduced, which results in 30% more power and fuel economy versus a conventional engine.
Now, the piston-related friction accounts for 45% of total frictional losses of the engine. And we can divide piston-related friction into three major sections, which is piston ring friction, piston skirt friction, and wristband friction. Now, the Taurosi design doesn't really do anything about the wristband, but let's pretend that the Taurosi hinge can magically completely eliminate all of the piston-related friction. So we have reduced friction by 45%. Does that mean that we have 45% improved fuel economy? No. Frictional losses account for only 10 to 15% of the total losses of the engine. Let's be pessimistic. Let's say that frictional losses are 15%. Although the latest engines can do something like 8 or 9%, but let's say it's the 80s and frictional losses are 15%. If we completely eliminate all of the piston-related friction with the Taurosi hinge, we have eliminated only 45% of this 15%. That means that we have reduced overall efficiency only by 6.75%. But of course, it's not even 6.75% because we have been overly optimistic with our assumptions. The Taurosi control arm does not eliminate the friction of the entire piston assembly. Of the 45% total piston friction, rings account for 22.5%, the skirt accounts for 12.5%, and the wrist pin is the remaining 10%. Let's assume that the Taurosi design reduces ring friction by half because we got rid of the oil ring pack and we eliminate piston rocking. As we know, we completely eliminate the skirt friction and we don't do anything about the wrist pin. So more realistically, we reduce total friction by 21.25%, not by 45%. If we assume the total friction losses are 15%, then we improve efficiency by 3.2%. If frictional losses are 10%, then we improve efficiency by 2.1%. So 30% efficiency improvement, not even close. It's more realistically somewhere between 3.2 and 2.1%. That's not bad. Every little bit counts, right? Well, yeah, wait till I tell you about the price. But before I tell you about the price we pay for the efficiency improvement, I have to answer a more imminent question. And that is, why would we bother with this big hinge mechanism to achieve such a small efficiency improvement? Well, the reason is that the hinge mechanism doesn't just get rid of the skirt piston skirt friction. It also allows us to get rid of lubricating oil inside the engine completely. And it does that because cylinder wall lubrication is the only lubrication element in the engine that cannot be converted into a sealed bearing. All the other lubrication sections in the engine, main bearings, rod bearings, wrist pin, camshafts, you name it, all of these can be converted from plain bearings to a sealed bearing. Unlike a plain bearing, which needs a constant pressurized film of oil on it to prevent metal-to-metal contact, a sealed bearing is a maintenance-free bearing which has essentially grease inside it, and it's sealed either by a rubber seal or a metal shield. And these are lubricated for the life of the bearing. Now, sealed bearings are nice because they're maintenance-free. You never have to change your oil again, but they also suck at bearing a barrage of sudden, high, powerful loads. I know bearing is in their name, but the bearings that are good at bearing a barrage of big loads are plain bearings with a nice, pressurized film of oil on them. Sealed ball bearings have a problem with this because the point of contact between a ball and the surface on which it rides is exactly that. A point, a single infinitely small point. In other words, a very, very small surface area. If we combine a very small surface area with a large load, we get very high pressure. This is how a needle can easily penetrate your skin, even if you don't apply too much force, but a bottle cap cannot penetrate your skin, even if you apply a lot of force. The smaller the surface area, the greater the pressure. The greater the pressure, the greater the wear. In contrast to this, plain bearings have an oil film covering the entire surface of the bearing. And oil is amazing at taking loads, and if you give it a large surface area, it's going to take an incredible amount of torture and insane loads to break oil apart and allow metal-to-metal contact. This is why all large engines pretty much have plain bearings on them, and you will find ball bearings only in small engines up to about, 125, 150, maybe 200 cc of displacement, where we have a poor lubrication environment combined with small loads. Now, if we look inside a transmission of a car, you're going to find roller bearings inside it, and these replace the ball with a cylindrical roller, so now the contact surface area is a full line instead of just a point. More surface area means better load-bearing capacity, and transmissions are exposed to very serious loads, and roller bearings inside a transmission, they last the life of the transmission, usually the life of the vehicle. So can we use those? Well, not really, because the roller bearings inside a transmission are at the very minimum splash lubricated by transmission oil, so they are running in an environment of oil. What I'm trying to say is that a sealed bearing of any kind, a maintenance-free sealed bearing with either balls or rollers or whatever inside, cannot hope to last the load-intensive environment of an engine, and cannot hope to last the life of the engine, the life of the vehicle, which is usually around 300,000 kilometers. If you want proof, all you have to do is look at wheel bearings of a car. These are big, chunky bearings, sometimes even with two rolls of balls, and we can never hope to fit a bearing this size inside an engine. And also wheel bearings, they have a pneumatic rubber tire and a suspension assembly on their side to help them absorb shock loads. But even with all of this, they almost never last the life of the vehicle. The average wheel bearing is around 130,000, 140,000 kilometers. Some can maybe do more, but some are even worse. They do like 50 to 60,000 kilometers. So, yeah. To conclude, removing oil from the engine and replacing it with a sealed bearing everywhere shortens the lifespan of the engine. On top of this, sealed bearings are not just more expensive, but much more importantly, they are much larger in dimensions and much heavier, so they increase dramatically if you add them everywhere on the camshafts, main bearings, rod bearings. They increase dramatically the weight and the size of the engine. But wait, there's more. We just started paying the price. Next up, engine balance. These hinges that you can see running and working on the engine and moving around, they disturb engine balance because the counterweight of the crankshaft, it can balance out the big end of the rod and the crank pin. The piston can balance out another piston, but there's nothing that moves in a way that can balance out that movement of the hinge. So this means that the Taurosi engine configuration is really only suitable for a boxer configuration where the hinges can balance each other out. Single cylinders, twins, most other configurations, even V engines, the hinges will create an additional imbalance, which means that the engine will run rougher, it will vibrate more, and these vibrations will likely limit the RPM, the maximum possible RPM of the engine. On top of this, they are an added weight and added volume to the engine because you need this additional space on the engine to fit the shaft where you can then attach the hinges. And I think these pistons with a hinge are actually heavier than a traditional piston. Now, there is a claim on the video from Repairman 22 that says that because the piston now doesn't need a skirt, the piston with the hinge weighs the same. Again, no numbers to support this, no actual weights of these hinged pistons, but looking at it intuitively like this, the weight of the piston skirt is honestly minimal. It's just on two sides of the pistons of the piston. Many pistons don't have a full skirt nowadays, so it's really not that much. Whereas the hinge, intuitively to me, this looks heavier, which means more mass, and this again further limits the RPM of the engine. And now for the final part of the price, manufacturing. Yes, you can make a curved bore. Definitely not impossible. And the owner, the inventor himself, Eduardo Taurosi, he did make a curved bore. Now, I'm not sure exactly how it's done. It's not clear in the videos on his channel. There's just footage of a block being bored. We can't see how the curved effect is achieved. It's also not clear on the Repairman 22 video where something vague is said, like he split the engine, welded it, and then bored the curved thing.
He welded the block, refilling it, and then used a curved boring machine.
I don't know, but he did it, and it can be done definitely with a very large, very expensive, very, very accurate 5-axis CNC machine. You can definitely machine a curved bore. However, it is not as fast or as cheap or as easy or as risk-free as a, not really risk-free, but of a risk as small as the simple machining of a straight down bore. The risk is further increased by the fact that the position of the shaft where we attach the hinges must be absolutely perfect in relation to the bore. So if we offset the shaft's holes or the shaft itself, the space for the shaft, in any way, in any angle, even a tiny offset will result in a large change of the trajectory of the travel path of the pendulum piston. And now we don't have oil for any sort of margin for error. So even if you get the shaft machining just a tiny bit wrong, we'll get contact between the piston and the bore. Now, modern CNC machines, they are definitely capable of being very, very accurate. So this is doable. However, CNC machining is, in general, not as suitable for large-scale mass production as stamping, casting, and forging, because with these methods, you can make dozens upon dozens of parts very quickly. And then you have not that much finished machining to do. And this is why if you look at any car that costs less than your house, you're not going to find any part that has been fully CNC machined on it. Now, these blocks, they wouldn't have to be fully CNC machined. We can cast them and then they have to go into a CNC machine. But if you want to keep up with the casting, because the blocks come quickly out of the casting, then you would need a great number and a lot of space and a great number of very large, very expensive CNC machines working simultaneously to keep up with the production of the casting and make sense in a very large scale mass production. And now for the bonus, the VAT on the price. Observe the cylinder bore, the curved cylinder bore. It tells you that one side of the piston ring covers a greater distance than the other side of that same piston ring. This means that one side of the piston ring has to travel faster. This means that one side of the piston ring experiences greater acceleration. And that means that one side of the piston ring experiences greater forces. So now, instead of uniformly moving the piston rings like this, we are doing this to them. We are trying to twist and mangle them. And this explains why in the only mass-produced application of this engine, which is oilless medical air compressors, the piston rings were replaced with self-lubricating Teflon. We're not using any sort of conventional metals like in conventional engines. Why? Because the oil ring that the Taurosi engine is missing is called the oil control ring. It's not called the oil elimination ring. And what it does is that it allows a very thin little film of oil to remain past it, to remain above it. And then the compression rings above the oil ring, they ride on this tiny little film of oil, which helps extend their life and helps lubricate things and helps them deal with all the motions of the piston. When we completely remove oil from the engine and then on top of this add crazy twisting, mangling motions to the rings, they have no hope of lasting if they're made from a conventional metal. And so we need self-lubricating Teflon. Now, self-lubricating Teflon is acceptable in a combustionless environment of an air compressor, but inside an actual engine, it is the equivalent of a wet biscuit. Now, something very important before we end here that I must stress with great stressness is that I'm not trying to be in any way disrespectful or that I want to downplay the life's work of the inventor Eduardo Taurosi. In fact, I very, very much genuinely and honestly admire this man and his creativity, ingenuity, and dedication and perseverance to take an idea from your mind and turn it into something that is not easy to make with basic tools, which he seems to have had at his disposal. And he turned this engine into a reality. It ran and it worked and he drove it. And then the engine actually found an application in these medical compressors. So this is very much a great achievement, and it is more than most humans will achieve with their life. So huge respect and definitely hats off to Eduardo Taurosi. No doubt about that. Very much admire what he has done. He's obviously a
passionate and dedicated man. The only thing that I'm commenting with this video, the only thing that where I disagree with him is that this engine had some sort of potential to be in a mass market vehicular application. He seems to think that. He tried to prove it by doing the car engine and the karting. I think that this engine never had, and this particular design never will have, potential for a mass market vehicular application due to all the reasons we just discussed. So yeah, there you have it. Taurosi Pendulum engine. You can stop asking for it now in the comments, please. As always, thanks a lot for watching, and I'll be seeing you soon with more fun and useful stuff on the D4A channel.